This is the Improved Photography Podcast, episode number 80. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, and online store. For a free trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com and enter offer code IMPROVE at checkout. A better web starts with your website. Everybody, and welcome back to the Improved Photography Podcast. I'm glad you're with us. Thank you for the download and the support of the podcast. You are joined right now by thousands of photographers from all around the world, and we're all here ready to learn photography. Some of us are professional photographers, some are hobbyists, some serious hobbyists, and some people are just parents that want to take better pictures of their kids at the soccer game. As always, I am joined by my friend, Darren Meller, ready to talk some photography.
Hey, Jim, how are you doing today?
I am doing great. I got to go car shopping later, though, which I'm not looking forward to. Oh, man, salesmen are tough to deal with.
Yes, they sure are. At least, hopefully, it'll be a cool car to photograph again, and maybe you can use it in one of your lessons on photoclasses.com. I really enjoyed that one.
Yeah, I hope maybe we'll do that. But today we don't have to deal with salesmen right now. We're just listening to some photography questions from listeners, and we're going to talk through some of the answers. I think there's something for everybody to learn. First question is about Canon lenses.
Hi, Jim. My name is Michael from michaelseger.com, and I live in sunny Sydney, Australia. I have a question about weather sealing on camera lenses, specifically Canon. I recently did a night landscape shoot in the pouring rain with my new 5D Mark III and L lenses. After the shoot, I dried the barrel of my 24-105 with a cloth, but since then I've read that this specific lens isn't fully weather sealed, and now I'm paranoid that I've ruined my new lens. Is there a way to check if I've caused any water damage to the lens, and how can I protect the lens in future? Love your podcast, and thanks for your online classes. They've been a great help to me.
All right, Darren, you shoot Canon. I think this question will kind of go either way, but if you're worried about getting some water damage in a lens, can you think of something you'd do to kind of check to see if it's doing okay?
I would wait for the lens to normalize as far as being in a drier situation, and then I'd go out and shoot it at a higher aperture and shoot the sky, kind of similar to what I would do to check for dust on my sensor. And I honestly, my heart dropped when I heard that question too, when you found out it wasn't weather sealed. But when it comes down to it, I would take a look at the sharpness and pull the photos into Photoshop or Lightroom, blow them up real big and see if there's any signs of water through there. And another simple thing to do is take the lens off the camera and look through it and manual focus it to see if you see any condensation in there. And that would be my main thing to look at to see if the water actually did impact the lens. But like I said, my heart did drop when I heard that happen.
Yeah, this is kind of a tough problem to check out, because if there was water that got in the lens and it's toward the rear of the lens, toward the part that mounts on the camera, it's going to be pretty obvious. If it's toward the front of the lens, and this goes the same with scratches and anything that's toward the front of the lens, the big end of the lens, the front element, it's a lot harder to see those problems, just the way the optics work. You can get a pretty severe scratch on the front element of your lens and it'll work fine. No problem at all. I even saw one lens that had a serious crack in the front element of the lens, and you really couldn't tell any huge problem right off the bat when you were shooting wide open. You stop down and oh yeah, you can definitely tell. But it's amazing how much damage that front element can take and not severely impact the image. So with this water, it kind of depends on where it is if we're really going to find it. But what I would do is I would open the aperture manually. So on the back of the lens, there's just like this little knob, this little slit, this switch that you can move manually, and it's opening and closing the aperture. And so if you do that and look through the rear element forward at something, you know, like the blue sky, something like that, like you said, then you may be able to see if something's going on. I don't know, but really, I don't know. Water's a little bit tough. If it was dirt or something, it is going to be easier to see. But I don't know. Those are at least a couple things to check out.
I would check those out too, because it is very hard to see it if it's on the front side of the lens. One of my travel mates was shooting a wide angle lens and he had a rather large scratch, and he said when he first got it in the mail after ordering it on eBay, his heart dropped as well and found out that it didn't really impact the image. So it would be almost beneficial if there was any water in there to have it be towards the back end of the lens where it mounts to the camera. So that's a great suggestion, to open up the aperture manually and see if we can actually see that water in there.
Yeah, but you know, we're all concerned about water damage because, you know, you don't want to ruin your gear, your expensive gear. But at the same time, I've had a lot of gear, even gear that's not weather sealed, in quite a bit of water, and it was just fine. Certainly not something you want to be careless with, but at the same time, you know, don't panic. It's probably gonna be okay, even if it's not weather sealed. All right, the next question is about getting your lens properly focused.
Hi, Jim. My name is Michael from michaelseeger.com, and I live in sunny Sydney, Australia. I have a question about focusing. I've recently purchased a Canon 5D Mark III to use with my collection of L-series zooms and non-L-prime lenses. I feel like my handheld technique is pretty good, and I'm commonly shooting around 1/25th of a second or higher, but it seems like my shots are slightly out of focus, especially at the wider apertures. I've heard of micro-adjusting your lenses, but I want to rule out my technique first, and I also don't want to attempt micro-adjusting until I understand it and comfortable with it. Is there something I can do to check if I do have a focus problem? And if I do need to adjust the lenses, how do I go about doing that? Love your podcast, and thanks for your online classes. They've been a great help for me.
All right, I think he's asking the right question. I hear a lot of photographers wondering about focus problems, and what I liked about the way that he asked the question is he wants to rule out his technique first, because 99.9% of the time, that's the problem. A really experienced photographer can pick up a lens and shoot with it for a couple minutes and know pretty quickly if we have a focus problem on the lens by doing a couple basic tests. But most photographers are going to have a really hard time knowing that until you've had just a lot of mileage with shooting with different lenses and different combinations.
Yes, it's like...
Go ahead.
Yeah, it's like riding a bike. I mean, you're going to figure out exactly what's wrong with this piece of machinery once you've used it over and over again and know how it's supposed to work when it's working correctly.
Right, yeah. So one red flag that I noticed was he said he usually shoots at 1/25th of a second or higher. That's a real scary thing. I would never, ever even consider the focus of the lens being an issue if we're shooting at that slow of a shutter speed. At 1/25th of a second, it's going to be 50-50. It may be a sharp shot. It may not be. Even with good image stabilization, it's just going to be some winners and some losers. So that's a very slow shutter speed. I would probably say we want to be at 1/200th of a second as a minimum when we're checking focus. Even if we're shooting on a wider lens, we just want to make sure that the shutter speed has nothing to do with what's going on. Because at that slow of a shutter speed, even the flap of the mirror is making a difference there. So that's the first thing. Then how do we check the focus to make sure we're okay, to know if we're front or back focusing? Well, it's actually not that difficult. There are some nice scientific ways to do this that we can know for sure, but just a real rudimentary, simple way to check this is get the camera locked on a tripod and then get a ruler and set it at an angle. Or a newspaper or whatever. We just need something with a lot of text on it, that we can see clearly if what's in focus and what isn't. And I would set it at a pretty steep angle. Then look through your viewfinder and zoom and get the focus right on one spot and take the picture. Then that's going to check your phase detection when you're using the viewfinder, but it's tough to get that exact, to make sure you're focusing on the exact spot. Then we're going to go on the back of the camera. We're going to turn on live view and we're going to focus that way, because here you can press the magnifying glass and zoom in all the way, and you can choose exactly what letter, you know, on the newspaper or ruler, just looking for some kind of letter there, and focus on one letter in a word and get that exact spot in focus. Take a picture, then change the focus, just rack the focus on the lens so it's totally off, refocus, and take the picture on the same letter. Do this 10, 15 times, and then look at the resulting photos on the computer. And what we want to check for is, one, is it consistently focusing on that exact same spot, on the same letter, on the same mark on the ruler, the same line? Or is it, you know, just a little bit scattered where it's just not quite, it's not quite in there the same time? Now, the way to fix this, if we want to do micro tune on your lenses, is you want to see, you know, are we consistently focusing too far back or too far forward? If that's the case, then we can just fine tune our autofocus and we got this problem fixed. The real problem is when we get a little bit of a scatter and it's just not real consistent, precise focus every time. And then we got some kind of issue going on.
Perfect. I think that you covered that question in its entirety. There's running test with that. And then also one thing I would definitely take a look at with it being a 5D Mark III is take a look at the different focus case studies that they have with that. The 5D Mark III and the 1DX on the Canon side of things have the ability to fine tune your focus. And that might even help with your action shots. Like Jim was saying, if you're shooting at a slower shutter speed, like a 1/25th of a second, you're going to get some blur. So definitely crank that shutter speed up and perform some tests before, you know, fine tuning your lens.
Yeah, and I guess one more thing to add there is you want a lot of light. If doing this inside probably isn't a great idea unless you got a softbox or something you can turn on right by the focus target, or you know, if there's a few windows in the room to really be bright. Your camera's going to have a harder time finding the focus point if it's a little bit darker in the room. So get a nice bright area where you can test this.
Exactly. And he mentioned he's in sunny Australia, so don't go out in the middle of the night to try to perform these tests.
Yeah, you should have a good time with this. All right, the next question is about finding a guide for photo trips.
Hi, Jim. It's Stephen Campbell at Stephen Campbell Photography from Charleston, South Carolina. And my question is on finding a good guide or fixer to show you locations when you're going out of town. How would one go about finding someone to do that? And how would you make sure that he's just not going to take you to the tourist locations in that area and take you somewhere less frequented by people? Any suggestions you have are greatly appreciated. And say hello to Dusty O for me. Thank you.
All right, so he's looking for a guide for photo locations. I have a couple things to add on this, and then I want to hear your input as well, Darren. The most important thing, I think, in my mind, is to not find a general tour guide. Getting a general tour guide can be worse than having no guide at all, because they don't know anything about the photography. And so they'll say, great, I'll pick you up at your hotel at 10 a.m. And you're like, what? What am I going to shoot at 10 a.m.? If I'm doing photography, I want to be out at 5 a.m.
Exactly.
And be there when the sun rises. They're going to take you to a lot of areas that may be very interesting, like a museum, but have very little photographic value. Like a museum where you may not be able to take pictures at all. They just won't have what you're looking for. What I look for in a guide is a photographer. Every time I want to go somewhere new, I only want a photographer as my guide. And that usually does wonders. It makes a huge difference in the quality of guide that I get. It doesn't so much matter that they're, you know, an incredible photographer. I just want somebody who thinks like a photographer does. I'm not looking for them to say, ooh, this is the composition right here, and, you know, kind of walk me through the shot. I want them to think like a photographer, know that we're looking for light in interesting places and to be there at the right times for that light. And that helps tremendously. But it doesn't always necessarily have to be a photographer. For example, you may be traveling in another country where your real concern is just safety and you'd like to have a guide with you for that reason. Or you may be shooting wildlife photography where really I don't so much care that you know about the light and stuff. Just show me where the animals are. And like when I went to Yellowstone, I got a guide to help find the animals. And he wasn't a photographer and it worked out just fine. Anything else you'd add to that?
I would add that, yes, make sure that they're reputable. Another resource, too, without actually coming in contact with the person is check out TripAdvisor. TripAdvisor is full of a lot of information as far as, you know, where to go to eat, but it also will show some cool spots that are off the beaten path. Like when I was down in Arizona in January, I found out some really cool places that were actually reviews written by photographers saying great photos, great panoramic views if you're willing to do the hike. And it's a great resource in that respect too. When you're in other countries, yes, it's a big concern to make sure that the guide is legitimate, but also when thinking about something like Yellowstone, make sure that it's not going to be a person who's going to take you to those spots like you've mentioned in the past that almost have dents in the ground from, hey, place your tripod here to get this exact shot of the Grand Teton. So I would just feel it out, use your instinct as well too, and just do research and making sure that your guide is giving you what you need out of the shoot.
Yeah, and TripAdvisor is a great advice. I used TripAdvisor, and I was so glad I did when I went to Hawaii, and I really wanted to dive and shoot sharks underwater. And I picked a guide, and I actually wanted to go a little bit later in the day because, you know, after all, it is underwater, and so it's going to spread the light out quite a bit. And I kind of wanted the sun flare up there. And so I decided I was going to go at, you know, 11 or 12 o'clock, and then I read on TripAdvisor that if you go later in the day, the waves are often so high that they have like an 80% cancellation rate because the waves are just too high to dive. And whoa, that totally saved the shoot. It was on my very last day in Hawaii and I only had one crack at it. It was a major reason I wanted to go. And so it would have totally ruined it if I hadn't checked TripAdvisor and read through some of the reviews to get that kind of information.
Yeah, I think the main theme is just do your due diligence in researching it. And I think you'll be happy with the result. Just make sure it's tailored to what you're looking for.
Well, our next question is about working with Lightroom and Photoshop, which is one of my favorite things to do.
Hi, Jim. This is Ben from Cranberry Township, Pennsylvania. You can see some of my work at apertureshift.com. I just had a quick question about the link between Lightroom and Photoshop. I usually do all of my Lightroom adjustments on a photo, and then if I want to go deeper, I bring it into Photoshop. I was wondering what is the best way to do this. When I'm working in Lightroom and go to open the photo in Photoshop, it asks me if I want to open the original or open a copy with the Lightroom adjustments, or I think a copy without Lightroom adjustments. And I don't know which is best for my workflow. I do use Lightroom as my photo library. I would rather not have a bunch of copies of the same photo that are in different stages of editing on my computer. What do you usually do? All right, thanks, Jim. Love the podcast.
Okay, I'm glad you asked this question. We've taken this same question from others before, and I wanted to include this one because before I failed to mention an important step in this process. And so I got some questions on it that helped me realize I've got to mention this when I talk about it. So the advantage of working with either in Camera Raw or in Lightroom is you get the capabilities of the Raw. Once you pass the photo from Lightroom to Photoshop, and you're just in Photoshop proper, not in Camera Raw, you've lost the Raw editing capabilities. Now that sounds worse than it is because you're working on a TIFF file or sometimes a PSD if you have it set up differently. But the default is you're working on a TIFF file. Now, to be honest, a TIFF file is so, it has so much information that it's pretty close to a RAW file. I think if I were to give you 10 files, some are RAW, some are TIFFs, and you couldn't see what the file is, and you were editing them in Lightroom or Photoshop, you'd be kind of hard-pressed to tell which one you're working on. A TIFF file has a lot of information. But the best practice is when you get your photo in Lightroom and you do your organization, make any exposure edits immediately. So if there's a global exposure problem, it's just too dark, too bright, whatever, fix that right away. Once you've done that, then go ahead and say open in Photoshop. You know, right click it, edit in Photoshop. When you do that, it's going to bring up a box that says, do you want to edit the original or edit a copy with Lightroom adjustments? And you're going to click edit a copy with Lightroom adjustments. Now, this creates a TIFF of the file that you were working on, but into that TIFF, it changes the exposure like you told it to in Lightroom. If you click edit original, then it just dumps the adjustment you just barely made in Lightroom and goes straight to Photoshop. Then you make your Photoshop adjustments and just hit control save or command save, command S, control S. And then when you do that, your changes in Photoshop are already reflected in Lightroom with that TIFF file that you had that exposure and the things changed in Photoshop. And now you're free to style the photo in Lightroom.
And that's the exact workflow I use as well. Sometimes it will create, you know, some virtual copies in there. And in my opinion, I think that the amount of space that it's taking up is negligible. And if you're doing a lot of pixel punishment inside Photoshop, you might see it add up after a while. But I think Lightroom is such a powerful tool that you're going to probably be doing the majority of your adjustments in there, which is something I really like to hear when that user had that question.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, before we go on, let's take just a minute and thank our sponsors. Our sponsors are Extrasensory Devices and Squarespace. Darren, tell us a little bit about Extrasensory Devices.
Well, we talked about this in the last episode, and it's a really cool device. They have this device called the Luxy, and the Luxy is an independent or light meter that you can actually use on your iPhone, and they're working on a version that's going to be working on the Android devices as well. It clips onto your iPhone, and I wondered how it would actually connect, and what it does is it uses your front-facing camera to meter the light correctly, so you're getting accurate light readings like you would if you were spot metering with your camera, and it's actually more precise in some cases. I know it might be cumbersome to carry something around, but it's attached to your iPhone, so it's a great little tool to have around. It's just as effective as using standalone light meters, and it's a fraction of the cost. I would definitely check it out on ESDDevices.com, and you can get 15% by using coupon code IMPROVE.
Very cool. And Squarespace is also a sponsor of the Improved Photography Podcast. I want to point you out to a cool resource on their website, which is squarespace.com/tour/photographers. Zero chance you're going to remember that later, so just go to improvephotography.com and look at the show notes, and we'll link over there. It's a cool page because it shows some of the portfolios from photographers you know, like Rick Salmon, who's a past guest on the podcast, and many others. And you can see kind of what they're doing with Squarespace, some of the best photography Squarespace sites out there. So I want you to point you out to that so you can kind of see how photographers are using Squarespace, because it's a great portfolio management tool, and it's just so simple to use. You know, it's inexpensive, starts at $8 a month, and it just works. You can be up and running like in an hour. It's just not difficult to set up at all. I also want to tell you, you can get a free trial and 10% off Squarespace by going to squarespace.com and entering offer code IMPROVE at checkout. A better web starts with your website. And as always, just go to the show notes if you forget the offer codes and the links, and we'll link you right over there. All right, Darren, we have answered quite a few questions, but we have three more, and this one is about shooting into the sun. We get a lot of interest from our students about shooting into the sun because it's just a really popular look right now to have that sun flare and kind of that washed out warm look from the sun. So let's hear this one.
Hey, Jim. I'm Ray from King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, and I have a sports photography question for you. I shoot a lot of outdoor swim meets where the sun is directly at my camera. It's at all the swimmers' backs, and there's nothing I can do about it. I can't really bring a reflector. I can't put up shade. And I can't really shoot with a flash because of the nature of sports photography and how quickly I need to snap my shutter. So I'm just wondering if you had any quick suggestions on what I can do to make the subject in the photo just as bright as the background. Any help is appreciated, and I love the podcast. Thanks for all your help.
All right. Really, when it comes down to it, this is a dynamic range problem. So dynamic range just means you have the brights are too brights or the darks are too darks. There's too much contrast in the scene to be captured in one photo. The same thing happens all the time with your own eyes. I was driving yesterday and I tried to see the stoplight, but behind it was the sun pouring like right above the stoplight. And you can't see what color the stoplight is because there's too much dynamic range. It's too bright and then too dark in the shadow on the side of the stoplight you're trying to look at. And so how do you fix it? Well, One is you can put your hand over the sun. You just reach out your hand and block the sun, and suddenly you can see the stoplight because now the dynamic range is less. We don't have that burning ball of gas up there. that's a dynamic range problem. We have it in our own eyes. We definitely have it in cameras even more severely. The same thing happens all the time in photography. A landscape photographer has the sun rising up. My sister-in-law called me yesterday, who is doing real estate photography for realtors, and she was trying to get a picture of the room properly exposed and also have the window properly exposed and not blown out. So no matter what kind of photography you do, you have dynamic range problems. It's going to be there every single time. And really, we only have a few tools to help us. So I'm going to walk you through those techniques, and then I think you're going to be able to answer your own question here, but we'll walk into it specifically with sports. One option is block the area that's too bright. So a landscape photographer may cut the sun out of the photo. A real estate photographer may not include that window that's just too bright. Another option is use something, a physical something, to block that area. Like you may use a graduated neutral density filter over the area that's too bright. This could work in sports photography, like the listener asked, but I mean that's going to be a little bit tough to do. But you know, if you're shooting a swim meet all day and you have a little bit of time to do something cool, then yeah, you might get a graduated neutral density filter and hold it up in front of your lens, and it's darker at the top and clear at the bottom, and the darker part's going to block out some of the light from that sky. So yeah, it's possible. It'd be a little bit cumbersome for sports photography, but yes, that could be done. The last option that I can think of, maybe you can think of other Darren, but really the only other technique that we have is something in the camera or in software, either way, that's going to actually just get more dynamic range that the camera is capturing. So that may be HDR, where you take a dark picture, a bright picture, and a middle picture, and you put them together. That's not really going to work for sports photography at all, because the person's going to move between the three shots. That's a bad idea. But what if you got one picture and you took it into Lightroom and digitally made it brighter and digitally made it darker and exported those three and then make an HDR? Well, yes, that could work for sports photography. It's going to exceed, you know, problems if you're shooting for a newspaper or something like that where you couldn't use this technique, but it sounds like that's not what's happening here. So yeah, that'd be something you could do. In fact, it could give really cool results. Just shoot the photo with the best neutral exposure you can, trying to get as much dynamic range as possible, and then make a faux HDR by just exporting those, and you're set. So those are the techniques. Those are the ways that photographers control dynamic range. I can't think of others. Maybe you're thinking of something else, Darren, but those are kind of the techniques we use, and then you just have to apply it to whatever type of photography you're shooting.
That was the same thought pattern I had in HDR, using it to make your own faux HDR. That could be a really cool result, but sometimes we're stuck with available light, and I think the best thing we're going to have to use is software to try to recover the shadows where it's too dark, and try to use a graduated filter inside Lightroom to tone down the sky so it looks a little bit more natural. I think software is going to be the biggest helper in this, or play around with a graduated neutral density filter would be another solution that Jim said would be cumbersome, but I think it'd be real fun to try out and see what the result gets you.
Yeah, I think it could be cool. And one other option is just forget about dynamic range. Just forget about trying to get the whole thing, and maybe make the person a silhouette. Maybe make this a really dark, moody picture, and you might get some great details that way. I wouldn't necessarily say if I can't get the whole dynamic range of the photos ruined, maybe you can do something cool too.
And one thing I thought of as well too is maybe apply using a circular polarizer there too. It might slow down the shot enough too, to where it blurs out the swimmer, and it might add a cool effect similar to what you had with the cyclist in the Olympic Training Center. I think that would possibly add a cool effect.
Yeah, good idea.
Awesome.
All right, next question is a lens emergency. 911 on a lens. We've got to figure out which one to buy.
Hey, Jim. My name is Jake out of Emeryville, California. I would like your help deciding which camera and lens combo to get. I have my eyes on the A6000 with an 18-105 f4 G-series lens, and I will be using it as an all-around camera for personal use, with some of the more common uses being travel, including backpacking, and then capturing fun moments in general, with friends such as at weddings. I currently have a T3i and will be passing this on to my fiance for her to learn with. And the ultimate goal is to only have mirrorless down the road with a set of lenses that are more or less interchangeable between the two cameras so that we can maximize value. So the T3i will likely be replaced in the next several years with a camera of the same family that I get in the near future. I am interested in having the future camera purchase be a full frame so that I have two slightly different camera types to fit a wider range of ideal shooting solutions. And this is why I'm leaning towards the Sony system instead of, say, a Micro Four Thirds only. As for lens selection, I would like a wider range than the 18 to 55 kit lens for better all-around versatility, but I'm not sure the much larger size and cost are worth it. Cost is not an issue per se. I've also considered other lenses such as the SEL 1670Z. So to wrap up, because I could probably talk forever about all the things I'm considering, my questions are these. Does it sound like a reasonable plan to get the A6000 now and a future Sony full frame? Would you recommend, even though they are bigger, heavier, more expensive? And finally, would you recommend just going the Micro Four Thirds route for the portability and plan on having two Micro Four Thirds cameras down the line instead of a crop and full frame pair? Thank you so much and keep up the great work.
Whew. What do you think, Darren?
I was actually dabbling with wanting to get a mirrorless system, but to be quite honest, I don't think that the mirrorless systems are quite there yet. There's some drawbacks with them as far as lens selection, and that seemed like a big point in respect to what he wants to get from this. And also, with the A6000 and at least the new Sony, I think it's the A7S, it's rated to have a really low battery life. And if you look at how many shots you're getting out of that versus a comparable DSLR in price, I think you're going to be more satisfied with a mirrored system. There's probably a reason why Canon and Nikon are hesitant to get really deep into the mirrorless system, because the DSLR system, in my personal opinion, is the way to go. It's the most advanced, it's tried and true, and this is just such a new technology that even on looking at Fujifilm, Olympus, and other brands, it's just not quite there yet for me.
I agree. We've seen some photographers online, such as Trey Ratcliffe, who, you know, with a lot of noise and announcement, are moving from a DSLR to mirrorless. And so my question is always, why? What is it that you're wanting to get on a mirrorless system that you're not getting on a DSLR? And as I ask people that question, I often get, I don't know. And I think it's that it's new, it's cool, we want something a little bit unique, you know, the latest and greatest. But the truth is right now, like, I always have to ask, what is the feature that you're not finding in a DSLR that you want in a mirrorless? In this case, a Sony A6000 is not like hugely smaller. You know, you're not going to fit it in your pocket, so you're still going to have a camera bag and stuff. It's a little bit lighter weight, but it's not like a tremendous difference from something like a Canon 70D or something like that. So it's not a huge savings on weight. And then the features that we're going to get in, there are some cool stuff. It's got a hybrid autofocus system, but it's still probably not quite as fast as a DSLR system. And then it's, you know, it has Wi-Fi, but it still isn't the Wi-Fi working how we talked about it in another episode, how we wish Wi-Fi worked. It has cool things on there, like what you can do with the focus in the viewfinder and zooming in, that kind of stuff. That's neat. But none of those sound like a significant or a justified reason to choose a camera system. Those seem like pretty tiny niche reasons to choose a camera system.
Go ahead. And especially if he's already shooting on the Canon system, I think that there's room to grow with another brand or another type of Canon system camera within the lineup. I think that he would be just as satisfied to explore his options there without having to drop the money on an A6000.
Yeah, I agree. I think if we really want to sit down before a camera is such an emotional decision. I feel like you got to write down on a piece of paper, I am buying this camera because, and you got to have some kind of answer other than it's cool. And as I look at the A6000, it has some neat features, but none of them would I consider as important as lens selection, as quick autofocus, things like that. And so that for that reason and that reason, and also, how about the fact of resale value? We just don't know where this Sony Alpha 6000 range of cameras is going. Sony has three major lens mounts going on right now, and they're not even sure which one's going to take over. So, you know, if your lens mount kind of dies off in the next 4 or 5 years while you have your camera, that camera's going to be worth nothing. A Canon or Nikon is going to have value four or five years from now. So right now, my official advice is hold off a little bit. Stick with a Canon or Nikon. They have great quality, low prices, and I feel like it's a known. I really think I am probably going to be shooting a Sony at some point, but I do feel like that day is still a year or two off, maybe two or three.
And the way I equate it is it's almost like the Betamax VHS war or the the HD DVD and Blu-ray war. People lost out in both of those. People bought the HD DVD and those are no longer around, and people bought the Betamax and they were replaced by the VHS. And I just don't want that to happen to anyone this early in the game.
Yeah, what's the rush? You know, if he gets a 70D, holds it for 2 years and waits to see kind of what happens with the Sony line, he's not going to lose a whole lot of money when he sells his 70D. And so that's probably where I'd go. Okay, so let's assume that we talked him into it, Darren, which we probably didn't. He's probably going to hear that and be like, whatever, man, I want something cool and new and shiny. But let's suppose we talked him into it. Does his the other person in his family, I can't remember if it was a wife or a girlfriend or whatever, is shooting Canon. Would you advise him to go with Canon, or is there a Nikon for a specific reason?
Well, based on the reviews I've seen in the past, I would start with price range. I would start with the Nikon system. In my personal opinion, I shoot Canon and I love Canon to death, but Nikon gives you more bang for your buck on the lower end cameras and what they have for his features. I mean, the 70D is great. It has some really killer features, but it's up there in price compared to some of the Nikon cameras out there that are giving you more megapixels and some other neat features.
Yeah, as far as the lesser expensive, well, I think all around the board, Nikon's just a touch less expensive right now as far as camera models going all the way up the line. There are exceptions to it, but I would say Nikon's a touch less expensive, including with lenses. You look at popular lenses like the 70-200 from both brands, 24 to 70s, etc. And the Nikon's just a little bit less expensive on all counts. So that may be a reason, but if you have another person in the family shooting Canon, that's a pretty good reason to stick with that. You can have one system, share lenses, you buy one wide angle, one telephoto, and you can just be swapping around.
And one suggestion I'd offer is, what was that camera that you bought your wife for having a smaller compact camera? I think that if he wants to dabble with something that's not a DSLR setup that still shoots some great photos, I think that, was that a Samsung that you recommended for your wife?
Yeah, it is a Samsung, and I don't remember the model name because you're asking right now. I'll think of it. But it's Samsung NX. It's the Samsung NX line.
Sounds great, and we'll definitely include that in the show notes as well.
Yeah, that was a cool travel camera. Is it the serious photographer's camera? No, but if you want a, you know, travel camera that's a lot better than a point and shoot, but not quite to the, you know, stuff of a DSLR, then that Samsung NX line is pretty neat. All right, it's been great to hear the questions from so many of you. Darren, you have any shoots coming up in the next week or so?
Yeah, I'm actually trying to avoid some rain here on Sunday. I'm doing a family photo shoot at a really cool lodge here near Nebraska City, Nebraska, and then I'll be doing a wedding shoot in November for a kind of a wedding reception. The bride's actually fortunate enough to get married out in Maui, and my schedule's not allowing me to travel out there to visit her here, but I'm very fortunate enough.
What?
Yeah, Maui.
You're going to skip the wedding in Maui? Are you nuts?
I know. I definitely am putting my foot in the mouth for doing that, but she is kind enough to allow me to do her reception here for the local people who also can't travel out to Maui here in Council Bluffs, Iowa, but I am going to be extremely jealous when I start to see those pictures from Maui pouring in.
Yeah, well, that's cool. I'm glad you're getting to shoot it. Well, thanks everybody for joining us on this episode, and we will see you in the next one.